Welcome. My name is Divine. I am a PGY1 transitional year resident. This is the 49th episode of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. We're going to be continuing our neurology clerkship shelf reviews. This will be the sixth part. So let's just jump right into it. But I'll just give a forewarning. I will encourage you, you really want to pay attention to this podcast, and here's the reason why, and you'll see why as we go along, but I can almost promise you that for those of you taking a neuro shelf, you'll probably get 10 to 15 questions correct, conservatively. This is me just speaking conservatively from this singular podcast, so I really encourage you to pay attention. I'll try to make it as short as possible, but try to make it as high yield as possible as well. So the first question, multiple neurologic deficits in a kid after getting the VZV vaccine or after, let's assume, a viral upper respiratory infection, right? So what's the diagnosis? So this is just something you need to recognize. It's kind of like along the spectrum of multiple sclerosis, but it kind of resolves after a while, right? But this is something known as ADEM, A-D-E-M. Acute disseminated encephalomyelitis, okay? The classic association on exams is a kid gets the VZV vaccine or gets any kind of viral vaccine or gets some weird viral infection. And then after that, they just have just diffuse profound paralysis. Think about ADEM, okay? It's basically you have a ton of inflammatory demyelinating lesions in the brain and spinal cord. I will imagine you probably make the diagnosis with MR imaging, right? So you get an MRI, and the norm in general is a full recovery. Okay. So next question. So this is the multiple sclerosis question, right? You knew this was coming up, right? And I'm gonna talk about the demographics of for MS. I'll talk about the associated vitamin deficiency. And I'll give you some reasoning why that may make some sense. We'll talk about the diagnostic testing. We'll talk about the CSF findings if you do a lumbar puncture. We'll talk about the classic cranial tube pathology and how it presents. We'll also talk about the classic exam presentations, right? I'll mention some things with that in a second. We'll talk about how you treat an acute exacerbation and how you treat chronically, okay, with disease-modifying therapies, if you may. Okay, and then we'll talk about treating the other stuff in MS, urge and overflow incontinence. They love to test that on neuro exams and also on OB-GYN shelves for some reason. And then we'll talk about how the muscle spasticity is treated, right? So the thing is, multiple sclerosis, the classic demographic on exams is a young female, okay? And almost always it's a young female in her 30s that has these disparate neurologic deficits. If you see that, think about multiple sclerosis. And usually these patients have vitamin D deficiencies. It may not even necessarily mean that they have a vitamin D deficiency, but low vitamin D, supplementing vitamin D, actually makes things better somewhat in multiple sclerosis. And this is how I sort of thought about it, right? So it kind of makes some sense, right? The thing is, the incidence of multiple sclerosis, or I guess prevalence, is much higher the farther away you are from the equator, right? And the thing is, as you go farther and farther away from the equator, you have less sunlight, right? And if you have less sunlight, you have more risk of vitamin D deficiency, right? And the thing is, actually, the further you go away from the equator, actually, the higher the incidence of, the prevalence, and I guess incidence of MS, right? So if going away from the equator increases the risk of MS, and going from the equator is associated with less sunlight, which is associated with less vitamin D, you can sort of imagine that giving vitamin D may sort of reverse that in some way, shape, or form. So sort of keep that at the back of your mind. It obviously doesn't reverse MS, but it helps, okay? At least many neurologists prescribe vitamin D to their patients. Okay, and the way you make the diagnosis of MS is with an MRI, okay? It's essentially a radiologic diagnosis. Patients with MS tend to get MRIs, I believe, every 3 to 6 months to sort of track the progression of their lesions, right? So if you see multiple demyelinating lesions separated in space and time, that helps you make the diagnosis of MS, right? And you get a brain and spinal cord MRI. The lumbar puncture is not necessary for diagnosis, but if they were to do an LP, it will show something known as an oligoclonal band, right? So it can be a non-specific IgG elevation in the CSF. And the classic cranial nerve tube presentation, right, it's optic neuritis, right? Do not choose uveitis, choose optic neuritis on your test. It's a super classic cranial nerve tube presentation. Basically, the way it will present is it will present as eye pain in the setting of a severe afferent pupillary defect, and it's an acute problem, right? So you see like a severe, profound, unilateral decrease in visual acuity in one eye, right? So classically on exam questions, they'll say, oh, the visual acuity in the left eye, the eye without optic neuritis, is like 20/20. But in the right eye, the eye with the eye pain, acute onset, blurry vision, whatever, it's like 20 over 200 or something ridiculous, okay? If you see a unilateral, acute onset, profound, afferent papillary defect in an MS patient, you really want to think about optic neuritis, okay? And the other signs that you may see on exams for MS, right? They, if they describe a patient that, oh, when they flex the neck, they have like a shock-like sensation going down their back all the way to the limbs, that's what's known as Lermite sign. It's a classic physical exam finding in the setting of multiple sclerosis. And then you may see that, oh, patients with MS, they may say like, oh, when they go out in the sun or when they take a hot shower, their symptoms get worse. That's something known as UTOS phenomenon. I'm not 100% on this, but I think heat sort of slows down conduction through nerves. So if you already have a demyelinating disorder, right? Remember, you need myelin to speed up conduction along nerves. So if you already have a demyelinating disorder and then you add a second heat by being in the heat, then you can sort of imagine that that would like profoundly slow down nerve conduction, and that can acutely worsen symptoms. And really, the way you treat acute exacerbations of MS, you give super high doses of corticosteroids, like 1,000 mg per day or something ridiculous like that. And really, the disease-modifying therapies, you probably don't need to know the mechanisms of action, but there are some key things you want to know, right? So, like, you want to remember, like, weird names. And the thing is, their names are kind of exotic for the most part, right? So, like, fingolimod is an MS medication. Natalizumab is another MS medication. That one, I found it high yield, at least for people taking step one, to know that it's an alpha-4 integrin inhibitor, okay? But a big thing you want to certainly remember on natalizumab is that it can cause a reactivation of the JC virus, okay? So it can cause a progressive multifocal local encephalopathy, so PML. PML from JC virus activation. And then you also want to remember gladiramer. Again, you don't need to worry about the mechanisms of action. Gladiramer is another treatment. Some physicians prescribe rituximab for MS. It works pretty well. And interferon beta is also a good treatment for MS. Please do not confuse interferon beta for MS with interferon alpha that's used to treat more like hep C, for example. And an easy way to remember that is like hep CIA, right? So hep CIA interferon alpha, so CIA, right? If you live in the US, you've probably heard of the CIA. Okay, don't worry, I'm not a member. Okay, so next. So urge and overflow incontinence. So urge incontinence, right, is where a patient cannot get to the bathroom in time before they pee, right? And urge incontinence, right, think of urinary urgency. They usually put that buzzword in the Q-stem. Okay, and urge incontinence, right, it arises from your detrusor muscles being like hyperactive, right? So like hypertonic detrusor muscles, if you may. So you sort of try to quieten them down. And the way you can quieten them down is by just blocking the muscarinic receptors that you find on their surfaces, right? So you can give drugs like oxybutynin, that's a muscarinic receptor antagonist. You can give tolterodine, right? You can give darphenazine, you can give sulfenazine and trospium. In fact, if I'm remembering correctly, I think when I was studying for step one, I learned a mnemonic about on the darn toilet, right? So the O is for oxybutynin, the T is for tolterodine, the D is for like darphenazine and sulfenazine, they kind of sound the same, and then the T is for trospium. I've actually seen each of those drug names on exam, so you definitely want to know those. And then for overflow incontinence, this is where it's kind of like the opposite of urge incontinence. So these people, their detrusor muscles have refused to contract, right? They don't sense when the bladder is full. So unlike urge incontinence, where those patients have like detrusor hyperactivity, right? With a low post-void residual volume. Contrast that with overflow incontinence, where they have like detrusor hypotonia. So the detrusor muscles don't have enough tone. And their post-void residual volumes, that's more for an OB-GYN shelf, is usually pretty high, usually more than like 300 cc's or 300 mils, for example. For those patients, you treat with you give something that can activate those detrusor muscles. So if we give a muscarinic receptor antagonist for urge incontinence, you want to give a muscarinic receptor agonist for overflow incontinence. So you want to give drugs like bethanycol, or you can give something that can boost the levels of acetylcholine, like neostigmine. Neostigmine is an acetylcholinesterase inhibitor. So by inhibiting acetylcholinesterase, it will boost your levels of acetylcholine, and those can activate the muscarinic receptors on the surfaces of the detrusor muscles. Another thing you could also do is you can do like a self-catheterization for overflowing continents, right? So like periodic self-cath. One other thing you could do is you could technically give like a tamsulosin to sort of open up the bladder neck so that they can drain their bladders easily. But that's really if ever tested on exams. And then the spasticity that accompanies MS, right? You can treat it with like baclofen, right? So baclofen is a GABA B receptor agonist. I already talked about this in a previous podcast. GABA is a calming down neurotransmitter, if you may, right? So it causes like, it reduces the rate of firing of neurons, right? So if you gave a GABA B agonist like baclofen, that can sort of quieten down those muscles. And you can also give tizanidine, right? Tizanidine sounds an awful lot like a clonidine, right? So that should help you remember that it's an alpha 2 agonist. Okay, so it's a centrally acting alpha 2 agonist that will decrease the release of norepinephrine, right? And again, sort of just think of it as, you remember, norepinephrine is something that you have if you're like in a hyper state. And if you want to treat spasticity, you want to go to a hypo state. So you give an alpha 2 agonist. Remember, those are GI coupled, right? So they are coupled to G protein coupled receptors. They are coupled to a GI, right? So those inhibit adenylyl cyclase. So you do not convert ATP to cyclic AMP. So those low levels of cyclic AMP, you don't activate protein kinase A, and you decrease the release of norepinephrine at the adrenergic synapse. Okay. You could also use dantrolene. I've talked about dantrolene in previous podcasts. It's a calcium channel blocker that you can use to treat malignant hyperthermia, or you can also use that to treat a neuroleptic malignant syndrome, right? And then you could use benzos. Remember, benzos are kind of like baclofen, but benzos are GABA A receptor agonist versus baclofen that is a GABA B receptor agonist. If it's like a localized spasticity, you can actually just inject Botox toxin into the muscle. Okay, remember, the botulinum toxin cleaves like snare proteins, so you do not release acetylcholine at the neuromuscular junction, right? So you get like a flaccid paralysis. So effectively paralyze the muscle under those circumstances. Okay, so I know this was a long slide, but MS, in fact, I will tell you this. If you finish your neuro shelf and you did not encounter any MS question, go back and look over your entire exam. Something has gone horribly wrong. You have to see MS questions on the neuro shelf exam. So just sort of keep that at the back of your mind. Okay, so next question. So this is slide 3. So classic exam presentation of vasovagal syncope. This one shows up in a pretty classic way, right? So it can be a patient that sees blood, or they undergo like a severe emotional stressor and then they pass out. That's vasovagal syncope. You can make the diagnosis with something known as the tilt table test. That's probably about as much as you need to know for exams. I mean, there's treatment, you can give like some sympathomimetics and all that stuff. Like midodrine, for example. Midodrine is an oft-cited treatment choice in textbooks, but that's very rarely tested. Just remember the presentation, like you see blood, you go through a severe emotional stressor, you pass out. Make the diagnosis with a tilt table test. That's pretty much all you need to know. And you can treat with midodrine if you have a bandwidth for that extra information. Now, next one, right? So the most common cause of death in patients with factor 8 and factor 9 deficiencies. Well, I'm really hoping you're thinking of hemophilia A. Remember, hemophilia A sounds like 8, right? That's a factor 8 deficiency. And then hemophilia B, right? Remember, like vitamin B9, right? Folic acid, vitamin B9, okay? So hemophilia B is a factor 9 deficiency. Those are both inherited in an X-linked recessive fashion. So if you see a girl with bleeding problems on your test, it's not hemophilia A or B, okay? Hemophilia C can show up in girls because that one is autosomal recessive inheritance, right? And the easy way to remember that is like, remember the, like pronounce the word car, like C-A-R, hemophilia C is autosomal recessive, okay? So if a patient has hemophilia C, right, they can show up in a boy, in a girl, but in a the only people that get hemophilia A and B on tests are guys, okay? Because they are X-linked recessive disorders. And really the most common cause of death in those patients is actually like hemorrhagic strokes, right? So they can have like intracerebral bleeds. Because remember, if you have no activity of factor 8 and factor 9, your intrinsic coagulation cascade does not work. So you cannot form clots. I mean, basically secondary hemostasis does not work. Okay, so you have an increased risk of bleeding. Remember, those patients can also have like hemarthrosis from bleeding into their joints. And again, it's X-linked recessive, so high yield thing to know there. So let's keep going. So the next The next question talks about the stepwise diagnostic testing in stroke management, right? So this one, basically, if a patient comes in with signs and symptoms of a stroke, like, oh, neurodeficit, stop talking, eye something issue, like sudden onset loss of vision in one eye, the first thing you want to do is a non-con head CT. You want to do a CT scan of the head without contrast, okay? The reason you do that first is because you want to differentiate between a hemorrhagic stroke and an ischemic stroke, right? The thing is, if you give contrast, then you don't know if you're looking at blood or you're looking at contrast in the brain, because blood essentially serves as its own contrast, especially on a CT imaging, right? So you do a non-contrast head CT first. That will help you determine, is this a hemorrhagic stroke or is this an ischemic stroke? If it's an ischemic say, for example, right, like worst headache of a patient's life, you do a non-con head CT, you don't see anything, right? You want to jump to a lumbar puncture, right, to rule out like a subarachnoid hemorrhage, right? Because a negative non-con head CT does not rule out a subarachnoid hemorrhage, right? So for that, you want to go down the pathway of getting a lumbar puncture looking for xanthochromia. Okay, and remember, for that you lower their blood pressure and then you can give them nimodipine so that you can prevent like the post-stroke vasospasm. But again, for just mainstream stroke, you do the non-con head CT, it's negative. Then the next thing you do is actually do a combination of things at the same time, pretty much, right? So usually the next right answer on exams is to get a Doppler, like a duplex ultrasound of the carotid arteries, okay? That will help you see if you have like, if you hear like brewery or whatever, right? To help you see if you have any kinds of issues with the carotid arteries, right? Because for most ischemic strokes, many of them begin from the internal carotids, not the external carotids, the internal carotid arteries, okay? Remember, the internal carotid, right, plays a big role in the vasculature of the brain. And then another thing you can do is you can do an echocardiogram, okay? To look for like a thrombus, especially for ischemic strokes, look for like a thrombus, like at the left atrial appendage, for example, or to look for a PFO, right? Patent foramen ovale, that may cause like a cryptic stroke, where things go from the right side of the heart to the left side of the heart and flick off to the brain. Okay, so first step, non-con head CT. Second step, get a carotid duplex ultrasound of the internal, not external, internal carotid arteries, and then you can also get an echocardiogram. Okay, and in general, if it's a hemorrhagic stroke, you try to lower the blood pressure, blah blah blah. But if it's an ischemic stroke, which is actually the most common kind of stroke, happens at about 80% of the time, you give aspirin. If you don't see aspirin as an answer choice, give any antiplatelet agent that shows up in the answers. If you see aspirin and another antiplatelet agent, choose aspirin. But if you don't see aspirin, choose something like clopidogrel or dipyridamole, any antiplatelet agent. Remember, there's a big difference between an antiplatelet drug and an anticoagulant. Your anticoagulants are things like warfarin, rivaroxaban, bivalirudin, dabigatran, and all that stuff. Those are anticoagulants. Those target secondary hemostasis, versus antiplatelet agents that target primary hemostasis, like aspirin, like dipyridamole, like clopidogrel. Okay, those are the ones you generally want to choose for strokes. The only time an anticoagulant like heparin will be the correct answer in the treatment of a stroke is if they basically tell you in the Q step that the patient, you auscultate the chest and you hear like an irregular murmur indicating that they have AFib. If a patient has AFib, that is the only time on exams, on neuro exams, where you give an anticoagulant like heparin or warfarin for the treatment of the stroke. Very, very high yield to know that. Okay, so moving on to the next slide, right? So I know some of you are probably hyperventilating by looking at this slide already. Don't panic, okay? But this stuff is super high yield. You'll see it on your neuro shelf. You'll see it on step one. You'll see it on step two. You'll see it on step three. I promise you that. So you might as well just learn it now. Okay, so match to the lesion cranial nerve, right? And this is actually in two parts. So the first one is paralysis of the ipsilateral upper and lower facial muscles, dry mouth, loss of lacrimation, and ipsilateral upper and lower facial muscle weakness. So this one is kind of high yield to know. This is a cranial nerve 7 lesion, right? This is the facial nerve. And remember, for your MBMEs, it's actually like mega high yield to know the difference between an upper motor neuron cranial 7 lesion and a lower motor neuron cranial 7 lesion. The thing is, an upper motor neuron cranial nerve 7 lesion, right, affects an upper motor neuron CN7 lesion affects the contralateral face, okay? But a lower motor neuron cranial nerve 7 lesion affects the ipsilateral face. So many times if people think of upper and lower motor neurons, the only thing they think about is like, oh, the corticospinal tract coming down to the anterior horn of the spinal cord and then supplying those anterior horn neurons, which are lower motor neurons. The thing is, your cranial nerves, all your cranial nerves are actually lower motor neurons. And well, I guess with one exception, I'll say, I mean, I'll have to do some research on this, but I'll say probably cranial nerve 2 is kind of different because it's actually an outgrowth of the diencephalon. But pretty much every cranial nerve is a lower motor neuron. The upper motor neurons that correspond to your cranial nerves constitute a tract known as the corticobulbar tract. Okay, the corticospinal tract is for the lower motor neurons that are in your spinal cord, but the corticobulbar tract, so corticospinal, lower motor neurons, spinal cord, but corticobulbar, right, brainstem, bulbar, corticobulbar are the upper motor neurons that come from the cerebral cortex, but they relate more to your cranial nerves. Okay, and just like the corticospinal tract, right, we have the fibers, they come down in the brain and then they decussate in the medullary pyramids, at the pyramidal decussation, and then go down to the lower motor neurons that constitute the anterior horn of your spinal cord. Your corticobulbar tract does the same thing. Those fibers come down from the cortex and then they decussate before synapsing on the nuclei of your cranial nerves. So if you have an upper motor neuron cranial nerve lesion, right, so a lesion of the corticobulbar tract, you'll actually get contralateral deficits. It looks like a mute point, but I promise you it's a super high yield point to know. If you have a corticobulbar tract lesion, that's an upper motor neuron cranial nerve lesion, if you may, you get contralateral deficits. Contrast that with a lower motor neuron cranial nerve problem where you have ipsilateral deficits. So this patient has paralysis of the ipsilateral upper and lower facial muscles, dry mouth, loss of lacrimation, and ipsilateral upper and lower facial muscle weakness, right? So ipsilateral to the lesion, right? So this is a lower motor neuron cranial nerve 7 deficit. The reason it's a lower motor neuron deficit is that it affects the upper and the lower face, okay? If you have a lower motor neuron cranial 7 lesion, you're affecting the facial nucleus itself, okay? So you will have issues with the upper and lower face, okay? As you'll see later, if you have an upper motor neuron cranial nerve 7 lesion, you have issues only with the contralateral lower face, only with the contralateral lower face. And the reason, again, I've explained why it's a contralateral issue, that's one, but the reason you have problems just with the lower face is that if you look at the facial nucleus, right, so the cranial nerve 7 nucleus sends fibers to the frontalis muscle, which regulates like you being able to like squint your forehead, if you may. So the thing is, the branches of cranial nerve 7 that go to the frontalis muscle, they actually receive bilateral corticobulbar tract innervation, right? So the corticobulbar tract from the left side of the brain and the corticobulbar tract from the right side of the brain both innervate the singular cranial nerve, like basically like the part of cranial nerve 7 that goes to the frontalis muscle. So if you have an like a corticobulbar tract lesion that's causing a cranial nerve 7 deficit, the thing that will happen is that they will have contralateral defects just for the lower face, because the other corticobulbar tract from the other side of the brain will take over the cranial nerves, will basically help out frontalis muscle. So if you have an upper motor neuron cranial nerve 7 deficit, you'll have issues just with the lower face, and the lower face issues you get will be on the contralateral side, on the contralateral side. Very, very high yield to know that. In fact, if I were you, I would rewind, I would go back like 2 minutes and just listen to this part, because it's just one of those things that just tends to confuse a lot of people. So I figured I might as well just take the time and explain it really well. So let's go to the next part of this, right? So loss of facial sensation, jaw deviation to the ipsilateral side, and an impaired corneal reflex, right? So this is a cranial 5 lesion. This is a trigeminal nerve lesion. If you lose, again, remember, facial weakness is not the same as loss of facial sensation. Facial weakness, remember, your muscles of facial expression are innervated by the facial nerve, but facial loss of facial sensation, right? Those are your, that's a trigeminal nerve territory, right? Like your ophthalmic, maxillary, and mandibular nerve divisions, right? So this is a cranial nerve 5 problem. And remember, the corneal reflex, right? The afferent part of the corneal reflex is by cranial nerve 5, right? So like the first part of the fifth cranial nerve, the ophthalmic nerve, the efferent division of the corneal reflex is actually done by cranial nerve 7. Okay, so if you have an impaired corneal reflex, but they tell you that you've lost facial sensation on the same side and your jaw is deviating to the same side as the lesion, think about a cranial nerve 5, a trigeminal nerve issue. Okay, and the jaw deviation to the ipsilateral side, that probably gets you more towards the mandibular nerve territory, so the third division of the trigeminal nerve. Now, if a patient has anosmia, right? So that's an easy one. You probably will never see that on an exam. That's a cranial nerve 1 issue, right? That's the olfactory nerve. Although you may see this in the context of Common syndrome, right? So a patient that is infertile, or they are not developing a secondary sexual characteristics, or they never menstruate, right? Because their HPG axis does not work. Because in Common syndrome, your GnRH neurons do not migrate, right? But they also do not migrate with like your olfactory neurons. So those people have problems with smell, but they also have infertility. If you listen to my OB-GYN vodcast, you'll hear when I talk about hypogonadotropic, hypogonadism. Common syndrome will be an example of a hypogonadotropic hypogonadism, because you are basically killing off GnRH, right? So your gonadotropins don't work. So it's a cause of hypogonadism from a hypogonadotropic cause, if you may. Now, mydriasis with the eye deviated down and out, right? So this is obviously a cranial 3 issue. This is an oculomotor nerve problem, okay? Remember, the oculomotor nerve, right, basically innervates essentially all the extraocular muscles of the eye, with the exception of superior oblique, that's done by the trochlear nerve, that's cranial nerve 4, and lateral rectus, which is done by the abducens nerve, which is cranial nerve 6. So the patient has a down and out eye. They basically have like on opposed action of the superior oblique and the lateral rectus. Remember, the lateral rectus AB ducts the eye, and the superior oblique actually depresses the eye. Okay, so your eye will be down and out because you have on opposed action of those muscles, and you have mydriasis because remember, the third cranial nerve carries some parasympathetic nerve fibers, right? Sort of starting from I believe it's called the Edinger Westphal nucleus, right? So it carries parasympathetic fibers, like the pupillary constrictors. So if your pupillary constrictors are knocked out, you cannot have meiosis of the eye. So you have mydriasis. So if you see mydriasis down and out eye, think about a cranial nerve 3 lesion. And that can arise from many reasons, right? It can arise from a posterior communicating artery aneurysm, right? Because cranial 3 runs along with PCOM, right? So PCOM, if you have an aneurysm of PCOM, that can compress cranial 3 and cause problems, right? If a patient has elevated ICPs, right, and you're about to have like oncal herniation, right, the oncus of the temporal lobe, cranial 3 sort of travels like medial to it. Yeah, it travels medial to the oncus. So if you're having oncal herniation, that can compress the oculomotor nerve, and that can cause this same presentation. And the thing is, usually the thing that happens first, especially if you have a compressive lesion of the oculomotor nerve, is you get mydriasis first. Because the thing is, for cranial 3, if you look at cranial 3 as a series of concentric circles, the parasympathetic fibers run on the outside, the skeletal, like the nerve fibers that deal with the extra ocular muscles, run on the inside. So if you have a compressive lesion of cranial 3, you will most likely have mydriasis. But if you have an ischemic lesion, for example, like diabetes with cranial nerve 3, you will get more of issues with the extraocular muscles popping up first. So on the outside, you have the parasympathetic fibers. On the inside, you have the like the non-autonomic fibers, if you may, like the nerve fibers that go to the skeletal muscles, which are in fact the extraocular muscles of the eye. Okay, so that's just a mute point, but again, a high yield thing to know for exams. And then if they tell you that a patient has bitemporal hemianopsia and they have an afferent papillary defect, this is pretty classic for a cranial 2 lesion, right? An optic nerve lesion. Bitemporal hemianopsia probably means that you have a lesion at the level of the optic chiasm, right? So let's say, for example, like a pituitary adenoma or a cranial pharyngioma, right? That can compress the optic chiasm and that can cause a bitemporal heteronymous hemianopsia, because you're involving the left visual field in the left eye and the right visual field in the right eye. I'll encourage you to sort of diagram that so sort of makes sense to you. You basically have tunnel vision. So, yeah. Okay. So, next one. Contralateral facial weakness. Please don't get this one wrong. Take a pause here. Don't get this one wrong. Contralateral facial weakness with forehead sparing and loss of taste sensation with the anterior two-thirds of the tongue, right? So, this is an upper motor neuron cranial nerve 7 lesion, okay? So, contralateral lower facial weakness, that's a cranial nerve 7 lesion, but that's an upper motor neuron cranial nerve 7 lesion, okay? And the sparing of the, again, the forehead is spared. And remember, for taste from the anterior to thirds of the tongue, right? So the general sensation of taste from the anterior to thirds of the tongue is done by cranial nerve 5. Okay, it's done by cranial 5. Contrast that with the special sensation of taste from the anterior to thirds of the tongue. That is done by cranial nerve 7, the facial nerve. Okay, so that's why this patient has loss of taste sensation in the anterior to thirds of the tongue. And then the next one says horizontal diplopia with failed abduction on lateral conjugate gaze, right? So if you have problems with abduction, that tells you that you have issues with cranial 6, the abducens nerve, right? So the lateral rectus muscle has been knocked out, right? So you tell the patient, oh, look to your side, and they can adduct the contralateral, like one eye, but they cannot abduct the other eye. Think about a cranial nerve 6 lesion, an abducens nerve lesion, right? So that can arise in the setting of, that can arise in the setting of like a cavernous sinus syndrome or something like that, right? Because remember, the abducens nerve runs through the middle of the cavernous sinus, right? Or if you have like elevated ICP, right? Remember, the abducens nerve has like the longest course of all the cranial nerves in the brain. So it's very susceptible to elevations in intracranial pressures. Now, the next one says vertical diplopia. So this is not horizontal diplopia. This is vertical diplopia. Vertical diplopia with the jaw tilted towards the side of the lesion and difficulty going down stairs. This should hopefully get you thinking about a trochlear nerve issue. Trochlear nerve issue. Remember, the trochlear nerve is the only cranial nerve that decussates in the, like, dorsally in the brainstem, right? Like in the midbrain. So it can give you a contralateral finding. So if you see a contralateral finding with cranial nerve 4, that can actually be a neural motor neuron deficit, right? Because cranial nerve 4 decussates. It's actually the one cranial nerve that decussates in the brainstem. Okay, and the mechanism behind, like, the jaw tilting towards the side of the lesion, that is easily a 15-20 minute lecture. Is something that I'll need like an actual visual to describe. I'll probably describe it in a podcast I'll make like in a few weeks or months. Yeah, that's a very complex phenomenon, but not necessary for a neuroshelf. Just remember that your jaw tilts towards the side of the lesion and you get vertical diplopia. If you see that combination, think about a trochlear nerve cranial 4 issue. Okay, so slide 6B, right? So again, maxillofacial cranial nerve. Sensory neural hearing loss, vertigo, and an abnormal caloric test result, right? So that's the vestibulocochlear nerve, right? That's cranial nerve A. That's pretty easy. The caloric test, I'll probably describe the mechanism in a different podcast, but that's like cows, right? Like cold opposite warm same. I'll talk about that in a later podcast. Although I think I may have mentioned it somewhere, but I don't really remember. I mean, we're 49 podcasts in. This has been going on for a while, obviously. Okay, so, but that's a cranial 8 lesion. Now, division of the protruded tongue to the ipsilateral side. So think of licking your wounds. Remember, what's the cranial nerve that innervates all the intrinsic muscles of the tongue, right? That is
That is the hypoglossal nerve, right? Cranial nerve 12. Although remember that palatoglossus is actually one of the intrinsic muscles of the tongue, it's actually innervated by cranial nerve 10, the vagus nerve. There are certain rules that sort of like govern those naming conventions. They are known as, I will encourage you to look up Stern's laws. I don't have time to go into those today, so I'm going to keep going. But palatoglossus is the only intrinsic tongue muscle that is innervated, that is not innervated by cranial nerve 12. It's innervated by cranial nerve 10, the vagus nerve. Okay, next one. Weakness in shoulder shrug plus problems turning the head to the opposite side, right? So that tells you that, I don't know, maybe like your sternocleidomastoids don't work, or your trapezoids. Your trapezoid muscle doesn't work, right? So hopefully you're thinking about the spinal accessory nerve. That's cranial nerve 11, okay, the spinal accessory nerve. So you have shoulder droop on the ipsilateral side and difficulty turning your head to the contralateral side. Okay, now, next one says loss of taste sensation in the posterior third of the tongue plus dysphagia plus an absent gag reflex, right? So hopefully you're thinking about a cranial 10. I mean, this can be a technically a cranial 9 or cranial 10 lesion, so they probably won't try to mess you up with that, but probably think more of a cranial 10 lesion, although cranial 10 does like the back of the tongue. So really, I'll say that really this is probably an ambiguous question. I'll say that, yeah, cranial nerve 9 fits for this, the glossopharyngeal nerve, because the glossopharyngeal nerve, if I'm remembering correctly from anatomy back in the day, the glossopharyngeal nerve does it does one pharyngeal muscle. I believe it's known as stylopharyngeus. But cranial nerve 10, the vagus nerve, does pretty much every other pharyngeal muscle. So yeah, this could technically be cranial 9 or cranial 10. So glossopharyngeal cranial 9 or vagus cranial 10. Okay, although for this one, I think I'll lean more towards vagus. But cranial 9 is also an acceptable answer. Okay, now, innervates the superior oblique muscle, right? So remember, like SO4, this is trochlear nerve. That's easy. Innervates lateral rectus, that's LR6, that's abducens nerve, cranial nerve 6. Remember, it's located medially in the brainstem, right? Medially in the brainstem, not laterally. Most pure motor cranial nerves, like cranial 6, are located medially in the brainstem. There's an embryologic reasoning behind that, but I don't have the time to go into that right now. Okay, now anosmia plus hypogonadotropic hypogonadism, already talked about this, common syndrome, cranial 1 deficit. Now, differentiating between an afferent and an efferent pupillary defect, right? So the thing is, you can differentiate between this by doing checking the pupillary reflex, right? So the thing is, for you to have the consensual, like, pupillary response or whatever it's called, if you shine light in one eye, that light, that sensation of light travels down cranial nerve 2 in that eye, okay, goes to like the pretectal nucleus of the midbrain, and then you have like a bilateral, like efferent response, where the bilateral cranial nerve 3s send out that information through the pupillary constrictors from in conjunction with like the Edinger-Westphal nucleus, and then you have bilateral pupillary constriction. So the thing is, if a patient has an afferent pupillary defect, okay, so let's say, let me pick one eye, let's say like the right eye, so they have like a right cranial nerve 2 defect. If they shine light in the right eye, they would not have bilateral constriction of the pupils because the information is just not making its way to the brain. But for those people, if you shine light in the left eye, you are getting the information into the brain through the left cranial nerve 2, and the left cranial nerve 2 for the pupillary light reflex projects bilaterally to the cranial nerve 3s, right? So those people, if you actually shine light in the eye that does not have the afferent pupillary defect, they will have bilateral pupillary constriction. That's an afferent, so an A, like an A, like apple, like an apple afferent pupillary defect. Contrast that with an efferent pupillary defect, like an E, like an egg, right? So like an efferent pupillary defect, that's an issue with cranial nerve 3, okay? So let's say a patient has an efferent pupillary defect on the left, for example. If you shine light in the right eye, the information travels to the brain. It's projected to both cranial nerve 3s, right? But you only get constriction of the right cranial, of the right pupil. You won't get constriction of the left pupil because the left cranial nerve 3 is not functional on that side. If you also shine light in the left eye, right, again, the cranial 2 in the left eye is working fine. So the information travels to the brain. It projects bilaterally, right? So you have constriction again of the right pupil, but you actually will not have constriction of the left pupil because that cranial 3 does not work. So basically, if you have an efferent pupillary defect, the eye with the defect will not have constriction. If you shine light in either eye for the pupillary light reflex. But if a patient has a cranial nerve 2 deficit, like an afferent pupillary deficit, if you shine light in the eye that does not have the afferent pupillary defect, you will have bilateral pupillary constriction. You may say, ah, oh, Divine, this is super low yield. I promise you, I literally have no reason to lie to you, right? I promise you, these concepts are super high yield. It's something that you may be out of the blue, shop on step 2CK. I will encourage you to learn this, especially for your neuro shelf, super, super high yield to understand that. Okay, so moving on to slide 7. This one's an easy slide. The most common pediatric brain tumor, that's a pilocytic astrocytoma. That's an easy one. And again, it's usually shows up like in the posterior fossa. Now, what would your diagnosis be if the exam describes a hemorrhagic lesion in the cerebellum with a pathology specimen revealing some kind of rosette? So like perivascular rosette, homoroid rosette. Hopefully this gets you thinking of a medulloblastoma. In fact, a medulloblastoma is the second most common pediatric brain tumor. It almost always shows up in the cerebellum on neuro exams, or I guess MBM exams in general, and it almost always presents with ataxia, okay, and elevated intracranial pressures, okay, medulloblastoma. And please don't forget that medulloblastomas, right, can arise in the setting of colon cancer. I believe that's a Torkel syndrome, right? So like brain tumors plus colon cancer, that's like an APC gene mutation. That's Torkel syndrome, right? Like remember like the turban, help you remember the brain. Okay, good. Now the last one, brain tumor that drains motor oil fluid and is calcified or could present with tunnel vision, right? So this is a craniopharyngioma. If you want that to be like a high powered pathologist, you can call this an adamantinomatous craniopharyngioma. It's the same thing, okay? High yield things he tests with this tumor, right? It can cause a bitemporal hemianopsia because you can essentially compress the optic chiasm, right, if you have a craniopharyngioma. And another high yield thing you definitely want to know is that this arises from Radke's pouch, okay? They can very easily weave this as an embryology question on a neuro MBME, okay? Radke's pouch is the embryologic origin of a craniopharyngioma. And classically, they may say that it's like it drains like motor oil, like just like oily fluid from a brain tumor. Pretty much stop reading the question. That's a craniopharyngioma. It's a pretty classic thing. And this tends to be supratentorial, unlike most pediatric brain tumors that tend to be infratentorial. And it's usually calcified on imaging. And while we're on that topic, if you see like an abdominal mass in a pediatric question and it's calcified and it crosses the midline, what are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're thinking about a neuroblastoma, okay? A neuroblastoma, it's usually calcified, it crosses the midline. It can also show up as a posterior mediastinal mass, right? And it can cause like weird like eye movements and weird limb movements, right? I think they call it like opsoclonus, myoclonus syndrome or something. It has a classic association with a neuroblastoma. Okay, good. Now, next one. Okay, so this one is kind of annoying. So this is actually in three parts. I apologize. But again, you need to know this for your test, right? Because if you've done the practice test, you've probably seen where they ask like, oh, this patient's deficit arises from, is it a cortical structure or a subcortical structure? Or is it from the basal ganglia? Or is it from the thalamus? Or is it from the spinal cord? Or is it from a nerve root? Or is it from a peripheral nerve? Or is it from muscle? Right. So let's sort of talk about that real quick. So if they tell you a patient has like neck pain radiating to the arm, right? And then they tell you that, oh, there are specific like dermatomes affected and like multiple peripheral nerves involved, you want to think about a radiculopathy, okay? A radiculopathy is a problem at the nerve root. Contrast that with a myelopathy, which is a problem with the spinal cord. Okay, so that's a radiculopathy. Classically, it shows up like in a dermatomal distribution of symptoms. That's one. It can show up like this patient I'm describing. He has a cervical radiculopathy, right? So like neck pain radiating down the arm. Okay, and they tell you that like multiple peripheral nerves are involved. Think about a radiculopathy. Okay, so that's a problem with a nerve root. So again, dermatomal distribution of symptoms, multiple peripheral nerves involved, shooting pain, right, in a dermatomal distribution, like neck pain radiating down somewhere. Think about a nerve root issue.
Okay, for this specific example, this is a cervical radiculopathy. Okay, and again, the reason you have multiple peripheral nerves involved is that, right, like C5, like the nerve root C5 relates to multiple nerves, right? Like the axillary nerve takes some part of C5, the median nerve takes some part of C5, the musculocutaneous nerve takes some part of C5, right? So many things sort of like depend on that one source nerve root, so multiple peripheral nerves can be involved. And then the next one says complete paralysis of the face, of the arms and legs with no sensory losses. And then this patient has contralateral clumsiness. So this is a subcortical issue. If you want to get a little more specific, this is actually an issue at the level of the internal capsule. Okay. An issue at the level of the internal capsule. Okay. So remember, if you're going back to like preclinical sciences, which I'm sure many of you have probably forgotten. If you're going back to preclinical sciences, and again, you don't need to remember that in like crazy detail, but if you go back there, remember that the internal capsule, right, like the posterior limb of the internal capsule, a lot of fibers sort of like scrunch into that space and get transmitted on the way down from the corticospinal tract coming from the brain. So if you have like a dense like motor loss and they tell you that, oh, you have paralysis of the face, arms and legs on like the opposing side, there are no sensory losses, and also on the opposing side there's like a clumsiness of like the upper extremity, think about an internal capsule issue. Okay, in fact, if I'm not mistaken, this is potentially the pathophysiology behind one of the ischemic stroke syndromes known as dysarthria clumsy hand syndrome. If I'm not mistaken, dysarthria clumsy hand syndrome. So I'll encourage you to sort of maybe look that up. But yeah, this is an internal capsule issue. And remember, right, your internal capsule can be infarcted if you have like a lesion of the lenticulostriated arteries. I know I've talked about this in some podcasts in the past. Okay, now, inability to calculate, so that's acalculia. Eyes looking towards the side of the lesion. Okay, facial paralysis contralateral to the side of the lesion in the lower face, plus upper motor neuron signs, right? So basically, I'm just using this question to help you differentiate between a dominant and a non-dominant parietal lobe lesion, although I will also describe why we get the other deficits, right? So the thing is, if you're right-handed, your dominant parietal lobe is the contralateral parietal lobe. So if you're right-handed, it's your left parietal lobe that's probably dominant. If you're left-handed, it's probably your right parietal lobe that is dominant, right? So if you have a dominant parietal lobe lesion, you will have problems with like calculating things like acalculia, or you'll have problems like writing like agraphia, right? So those are like the big things you find with a dominant parietal lobe lesion. But for a non-dominant parietal lobe lesion, right, so let's say you're right-handed, your non-dominant parietal lobe will be your right parietal lobe, right? So if you have like a non-dominant parietal lobe lesion, those people tend to have like neglect symptoms, right? So like they neglect like one side of their body or one side of their face. Like you can see people like they shave one side of their face, they don't shave the other side. That's a non-dominant parietal lobe lesion. So these are cortical, right? So remember the first one I said was a radiculopathy, as a cervical radiculopathy. This patient, the complete paralysis of the face, arms and legs, that's a subcortical lesion, right? Because it's an internal capsule lesion. Your internal capsule is below the cerebral cortex, so it's a subcortical lesion. Now this patient that I'm describing that has the all these issues, can't calculate, blah blah blah, that's the parietal lobe, that's your cerebral cortex. So this is a cortical lesion. Okay, this is a cortical lesion, and in this case this patient has a dominant parietal lobe lesion, right? But let's talk about the other problems this patient has, right? So eyes looking towards the side of the lesion, right? So this patient has basically lesioned their frontal eye fields. The thing is, the frontal eye fields, you need them for conjugate gaze, conjugate like horizontal gaze. Okay, the way the pathway works is the frontal eye fields, let's say the right side of the brain, the frontal eye fields and the right side of the brain, okay, they travel to the paramedium pontine reticular formation in the left brain stem. Okay, so they go to the contralateral PPRF. Okay, and the thing is, the paramedium pontine reticular formation on the left controls the abducens nerve on the left and the oculomotor nerve on the right. Because think about it, if you want to look left, right, again, walk with me here, again,
You may want to rewind this, and I'm sorry, I apologize. I don't mean to give you all these complex things, but neuro is just crazy complex for some reason, okay? Neuro is just crazy complex, but it's actually fun. I actually really love neurology, as you can probably tell from me giving so many podcasts. Although I promise, I'm not going off on a limb, all these things are higher for your neuro shelf. So, your frontal eye field on the right side of the brain goes to the paramedian pontine reticular formation on the left side of the brain stem, okay? And that would help you look left, right? So think about it. If you want to look left, your you have to abduct your left eye, right? So think about it. Look left, you need to abduct your left eye, and you need to adduct your right eye, right? So that they can both go in the same direction to the left. So if you want to abduct your left eye, you need your left cranial 6, your abducens nerve to work. If you want to adduct your right eye, you need your right cranial 3 to work, your right oculomotor nerve, right? So if you want to look to the left, your right frontal eye fields, they're in the cerebral cortex, must work. Your right frontal eye fields will send fibers to the contralateral, the left paramedian pontine reticular formation, and then your left PPRF will innervate your left cranial nerve 6, your abducens nerve, and your right cranial nerve 3, your oculomotor nerve. And I think actually the highway between those two is actually the medial longitudinal fasciculus, right? So if a patient has like a right frontal eye field lesion, right, their eyes will deviate towards the side of the lesion. So why is that? The mechanism behind that is, if you have a right frontal eye field lesion, by knocking out your right frontal eye field, that means you've knocked out your left PPRF, your left paramedian pontine reticular formation. If you've knocked out your left PPRF, that means your right PPRF will act unopposed. If your right PPRF is acting unopposed, that means you will have your right cranial 6 nucleus activated. So you abduct the right eye, and you have your left cranial 3 nucleus activated. That means you adduct your left eye, right? So your eyes will look to the right. So if you have a frontal eye field lesion, your eyes will deviate towards the side of the lesion, towards the same side of the lesion. If you don't want to memorize, if you don't understand, just maybe memorize it. But I think it's much easier to remember if you just understand it, because it's one of those things where if you sort of like rewind this, diagram this out, it makes perfect sense. Okay. But this again will be an example of like a brainstem. This will be an example of a brainstem lesion. Okay. Now, next slide. So 8B. So complete sensory loss on the left plus severe pain on the right. This one is just an association you need to know. This is a lesion of the thalamus. Okay. So again, this will fall under the purview of a subcortical lesion. Basically, if a patient has like contralateral severe pain, ipsilateral complete sensory loss, let me put it this way so I don't get things confused. If a patient has complete, like a dense sensory loss on one side of the body and severe pain on the alternating side of the body, think about a thalamic nerve lesion. I'm not going to go into any mechanisms there, but just think about a thalamic nerve lesion. That's not very high yield to know for exams. Okay. Now, ataxia, pass pointing, impaired rapid alternating movement, right? So remember the term dysdiadochokinesia, right? So that thing you tell your patients to sort of slap your hands on their thighs quickly, right? And an intention tremor, right? So hopefully this tells you this is a cerebellar problem, right? It's a cerebellar problem. And most cerebellar problems are ipsilateral, okay? They're ipsilateral to the side of the lesion. Now, bowel bladder dysfunction plus upper motor neuron and lower motor neuron findings plus a sensory level. This is floridly high yield for the neuro shelf. If you see the boss phrase sensory level, that is a myelopathy. That's a lesion in the spinal cord. Okay, it's a lesion in the spinal cord. Basically, if you have like a sharp demarcation after which you've basically lost like sensory and motor information, they say right beneath the nipple, the patient has lost all sensation, lost all motor activity. That's a spinal cord lesion. That's what's known as a sensory level, Okay, and the thing is, the spinal cord does control like bowel bladder function, right? So think about cauda equina syndrome, for example, right? So bowel bladder dysfunction, upper motor neuron findings, right? Usually the upper motor neuron findings are below the level of the lesion, while the lower motor neuron findings are at the level of the lesion. If you see that combination, you really, really, really want to think about, a spinal cord problem. Okay, next one is trouble swallowing plus problems with eye adduction on conjugate gaze plus sensory loss on the left face plus sensory loss on the right body, right? So this is, again, a brainstem problem, okay? So why is this a brainstem problem, right? The thing is, if you see sensory loss in the ipsilateral face and then sensory loss on the contralateral side of the body, that's pathognomonic for a brainstem lesion, right? Because remember that your spinal trigeminal tract that controls a pain and temperature sensation for the face runs laterally in the brainstem, right? It runs like ipsilaterally and it runs like in the lateral brainstem, right? But your body, pain and temperature sensation of the body, that's your spinothalamic tract, right? That runs also laterally in the brainstem. But remember that you've had an initial decussation at the level of the anterior white commissure in the spinal cord. So this patient that has trouble swallowing, that's kind of like cranial 9 through 10 and 12 territory. So this is probably a problem like in the lateral medulla, right? If you're using that algorithm I mentioned, like I think one or two podcasts ago. So this is a lateral medullary problem, right? So this is probably like the posterior inferior cerebellar artery that has been nuked. This, I believe, is known as Wallenberg syndrome. Remember, the posterior inferior cerebellar artery is a branch of the vertebral artery. Okay, so if you don't see pica as an answer choice, pick vertebral. But if you see pica and vertebral, pick the most direct answer to the question, pick pica. Okay, and then a hemibolismus bradykinesia. So let me even make this more complete. Contralateral hemibolismus and bradykinesia. Think about subthalamic nucleus issue, right? This is a subthalamic issue. And again, the subthalamic nucleus is a deep brain structure, so that's a subcortical lesion. Okay, now next one, stocking and glove distribution of sensory loss plus fluctuating diplopia, dysphagia, dysarthria plus lower motor neuron findings. So the thing is, I'm just gonna, in fact, probably forget about the fluctuating diplopia, dysphagia, dysarthria, blah, blah, blah. This patient basically has diabetes. But the thing I just want to mention here is that if a patient has a stocking and glove distribution of like sensory deficits, you really want to think about a peripheral nerve issue. That is the pathognomonic finding in a peripheral nerve lesion. If a patient has lesions in a stocking and glove distribution, you really want to think about a peripheral nerve problem. Okay, but it's one nerve that is affected. It's not multiple nerves. Multiple nerves, that's a radiculopathy. One nerve, that's a peripheral neuropathy. Okay, again, you may say, Divine, this is all low yield. I promise you, if you don't learn this stuff, you'll regret on your neuro shelf and likely on step 2 CK as well. Okay, now the next one says trouble rising from the seated position, so like a proximal muscle defect, if you may, plus an elevated CK. This is a problem with actual muscle. Right, so this could be polymyositis or dermatomyositis or inclusion body myositis. I talk about this in an earlier podcast and also in the medicine videos. But yes, this will be a muscle problem. If you see like proximal extremity issues, think about a muscle problem. It's a problem at the level of the muscle. One I did not include here, if you're thinking about a neuromuscular junction problem, so like a myoneural junction problem, if you may. So myoneural. Think more about neurologic symptoms that are fatigable, right? So like they get worse with further activation of the muscle, right? So like myasthenia gravis will be an example of a neuromuscular junction problem, or Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome. Although Lambert-Eaton is not a fatigable disorder, it's something where if you actually stimulate the muscle more and more, it gets better, right? So you have an incremental response of the muscle with repetitive nerve stimulation. I talked about that in a previous neuro podcast, right? So that'll be a myoneural junction issue. Okay, so if you see fatigable symptoms, that's pretty pathognomonic for a neuromuscular junction or a myoneural junction issue. Good. So 9, 4 signs of a basilar skull fracture. This is something you need to memorize, right? So like battle sign, right? So like basically like bruising behind the mastoid process. Raccoon eyes, right? So like bruising around the eyes, right? Raccoon eyes, that's another sign of a basilar skull fracture. If you see like CSF rhinorrhea, right? So like CSF literally like dripping from the nose, that's a sign of a basilar skull fracture. Or if you see like CSF otorrhea, right? So like CSF dripping out from the ears, that's a really bad sign. Again, that's also pretty pathognomonic for a basilar skull fracture. You make that diagnosis by like doing a head CT, right? You can see bone really well with CT imaging. Okay, now, and I've talked about how you differentiate between a peripheral neuropathy and a radiculopathy, right? So a peripheral neuropathy, one nerve involved, stocking and glove distribution. Radiculopathy, multiple nerves involved, dermatomal distribution, radiating pain from like one place to another. Okay, think about a radiculopathy. That's a nerve root issue. Okay, now last question, right? So question 10, weakness in shoulder abduction and deltoid paralysis, right? So that's an axillary nerve problem. That's a C5 C6, right? So that's a peripheral nerve issue. Okay, now weakness in foot eversion and dorsiflexion, that will be a peroneal nerve problem, right? So remember the first aid mnemonic, dropped, foot dropped. Like the last three letters of dropped is PED. So a peroneal nerve problem will cause problems with eversion and dorsiflexion. Okay. And then the next one says weakness in foot inversion and plantar flexion. So remember the first aid mnemonic, tip, right? So tip, tibial nerve. If you have a tibial nerve injury, you have problems with I, inversion, and P, plantar flexion. Now, weakness in wrist extension, that's pretty easy. That's your radial nerve, right? And remember, you can injure the radial nerve if you have a mid-shaft fracture of the humerus. A mid-shaft fracture of the humerus can cause a radial nerve injury. An axillary nerve injury usually arises in the setting of a surgical neck fracture of the humerus or in the setting of an anterior shoulder dislocation. Okay. And remember that your radial nerve does your triceps reflex, does your supinator, kind of higher things go there. Okay, now, problems with thumb abduction with sensory losses on the ventrolateral 3.5 digits, right? It's pretty easy. This is carpal tunnel syndrome. That's a median nerve issue, right? It's a compression by the flexor retinaculum, right, in the carpal tunnel. And remember that classically on exams, the classic populations that get carpal tunnel are people that have like edema causing conditions, right, like pregnancy, or kind of swell up everywhere in pregnancy, right, or rheumatoid arthritis, right, from all that inflammation, and also hypothyroidism. Those are like the classic demographics for carpal tunnel syndrome on exams. And then also people that do a lot of like furious typing, like office workers, or I guess coming a little closer to medicine, right? Like med students or people that are using Epic furiously during the day. So I guess like residents and interns, maybe not attendants. Okay, moving on. So problems with hip flexion, it's pretty easy. That's a femoral nerve. So remember the F in femoral for the F in hip flexion. Okay, problems with hip adduction, this one is easy. They'll tell you that the patient cannot, the way I think about it is I think of it as like an air problem, right? So like MacBook Air, for example. So they cannot adduct their hips and they cannot internally rotate their hips. That's an obturator nerve lesion, okay? That's an obturator nerve lesion. Now, weakness with a finger spread and problems with flexion at the MCPs, right? So the metacarpophalangeal joints and extension at the IP joints, right? So your proximal and distal interphalangeal joints. That's pretty classic for an ulnar nerve lesion, okay? So if you have problems with finger spread, that's an ulnar nerve injury. And there are nerve roots controlling the following reflexes. You basically need to know this. Like, there's no way around it. If you don't know it, you'll be doing yourself a big disservice on your neural shelf, right? So, basically, let's talk about these reflexes, right? So, the biceps reflex, it's like C5, C6. The triceps reflex, that's like radial nerve territory. That's like C7, C8, okay? The Achilles reflex, that's S1 and S2. And the patella tendon reflex is L3, L4. So I'll repeat that again. Your biceps reflex is C5, C6, triceps is C7, C8, Achilles is S1, S2, patellar tendon reflex is L3, L4. And if I'm not mistaken, there is actually a mnemonic. Yeah. Let me try to remember. There's a mnemonic in first aid, I believe, that makes this super easy to remember. It's like S1, 2, buckle, shoe. So that's like Achilles reflex. L3, 4, kick the door, something like that. So that's a patellar tendon reflex. And then C5, 6 has something to do with sticks. That's your biceps reflex. And then lead them straight. So C7, 8, right? That's your triceps reflex, right? It's extension of your upper extremity, right? So, yeah, S1, 2, shoe, something. I will encourage you to check first aid. You'll see the exact mnemonic for step one. First aid for step one. L3, 4 is like the kick the door. 5, 6, C5, 6, that's biceps. That's something with sticks. And then C7, 8, that's like something with like laying them straight or something like that. Okay. So that's all I will say with that. And then just some high yield dermatomes you probably should commit to memory for your exam. I'll talk about them real quick. The big ones you want to know. You want to know about your nipple line, right? So this one I do remember the mnemonic from first aid. It's kind of like, hope kids are not listening to this, but T4, like the tit pore, right? So like tits, like breasts. So T4, tit pore, that's T4 for the nipple line. The xiphoid process is T7, okay? And then the umbilicus is T10. The umbilicus is T10, okay? So I know this was kind of long, but please... all this stuff is high yield. In fact, I'll say of all the neuro podcasts I've made, this is the highest yield one. Like, I can almost guarantee 10 to 15 questions on your neuro shelf will come from this. And you'll see some questions on your Step 2 CK that will come from this one. So it's super, 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 super high yield to learn this podcast. I wish you all the best. I will probably make 2 or 3 more for neuro, and then I'll be done. Okay, I wish I could make a video, but I just don't have that technological capability right now. But I have some good stuff coming down the pipeline within the next few days for step one, and hopefully more students across the country can get some benefit from that. So please feel free to share the website. It's www.divineinterventionpodcasts. So there's an S at the end, .com. And if you have any questions or need guidance and stuff, or like tutoring, you can reach out to me, and I wish you all the best. Have a wonderful rest of the day, and God bless. I'll see you in the next podcast. Thank you.